So first of all, I'd like to get a sense for how many of you are managing Linux servers today? All right. And how about Linux plus Windows? Okay, all right. So I think we have the right set of demos and partners here for this the small audience. All right, so we're going to do some unconventional things today. Like, for instance, I am unconventionally presenting from an Ubuntu laptop. And what I'm going to do, instead of jumping into slides, I'm going to jump right into our first demo. And so what I'd like to do is kick off the creation of a Linux virtual machine on Azure. So the way that you do that is you you navigate to our WindowsAzure.com portal, and it's super easy. Just go down to New, Virtual Machine, From Gallery, and there what you see is this is the list of what we call our platform images. This is the base image set that's available to you when you're using infrastructure as a service on Azure, and you can choose from, as you can see, we have three different options for Windows-based virtual machines, and we have four different options for Linux-based virtual machines. So right away, you see that the work that we're doing for Linux on Azure is as prominently featured as the work that we're doing for Windows on Azure, which is part of the general theme that we'll talk about today in terms of Linux support being first class on the Azure Cloud platform, and our embrace of our new embrace of open technologies. Let's see. So I'm going to create an Ubuntu virtual machine. And optionally, I could upload an SSH key, so I could use SSH if I were to choose to. I'm just going to use a regular account. So that's it. That's all that you need to do to get going, get your virtual machine started provisioning. And so while that's cooking, I'll go over here to our slide deck. Okay, so today what we'll do is I'm going to talk a little bit about kind of our high-level motivation and goals for supporting Linux virtual machines on Azure, and then we'll have our partners come up that are helping us out by providing support for some of the leading Linux distros. And then at the end, we'll have a little panel of the Microsoft folks that are here and our partners, and we'll open it up for Q&A. So in terms of Microsoft's goals for why we pursued Linux on Azure and what we hope to achieve, like I mentioned, it's the approach that we took is that if we're going to go after support for something like Linux on our platform, we needed to do it right. And we needed to do it right because we have enterprise customers like yourselves that have mixed workloads, combination of Windows Server and Linux. And there's an expectation that those mixed workloads all run well, independent of what's running in the guest operating system. While it's the case that our enterprise customers are a primary target for infrastructure as a service generally, it's also the case that in terms of cloud adoption, the smaller ISVs are at the leading edge of cloud adoption. So it's important that we also have something that's credible for small ISVs, especially relative to some of the alternative platforms that are out there. And then in the spirit of the work that we're doing here, we intend to open source much of our related innovation. So if we're doing work, for instance, that's specific to enabling Linux guests on Azure, that work will open source and make available so folks can see the source code, modify it, propose changes, and so on. In terms of our roadmap, last week we announced our infrastructure as a service release, the preview release for infrastructure as a service, among other things. And with that, we announced support for the distros that are up on the display here. We're supporting Canonical Ubuntu, OpenSUSE, SUSE Linux Enterprise Server from SUSE, and we're supporting CentOS. And CentOS is provided by one of our partners, OpenLogic. So there are two different ways that you can get access to these distros. You can get access, as I've just shown you, through our portal in what we think of as our curated set of platform images that come from our distro partners. But you can also bring your own Linux VHD if you like. So there are some instructions at this URL. You can also easily find it from azure.com for creating a VHD in your local environment. And then what you can do is you can configure it using whatever existing tools. If you're running Hyper-V, let's say, and in Linux and Windows Server locally, you can use whatever tools that you use for creating your VHDs and use them in conjunction with Azure. So it should be really straightforward. Now, in terms of future, where we're headed, over time we'll support additional distros. There is a long tail of distros that are out there. And as we're going out and we're talking to customers, it seems like new requests for new distros keep popping up. So we'll continue with the notion of having a short list of curated images for some of the leading distros. But in addition to that, we're working on a community repository so that the community can upload VHDs from the large variety of distros that are out there, and they can upload VHDs with custom application stacks that that our customers can download and use. And then over time, we will support more premium enterprise services like patching as well as phone support. So that's kind of where we're headed. And let's go back to the demo. We'll see how our virtual machine is doing. Okay, so it's up and running, and so what I'm going to do now is I am going to SSH. So there we are. So there is a Linux virtual machine, Ubuntu server, running on our cloud platform. And I can do all the great things that I can do on any Linux virtual machine. So what I'm going to do, though, is I'm going to show you how easy it is to set up Apache and get it going. So let's see here. So one of the things that you should notice here is how quickly Apache downloads and is being installed. And the reason that's the case is because working with our partners, we've co-located repositories for each of our distros in each of the data centers where IaaS virtual machines run. So what's happening here is it's sucking down the Apache 2 package. It's sucking it down from one of the servers in the Azure cloud platform. All right. Oops. Here's our default web page. Oops, did not do that. So now, in order to get access to that, I need to open up port 80. On my virtual machine. It's really easy. using our cool new portal. So one of the things, while that's working, one of the things that is kind of neat is that if you do have mixed workloads that are a combination of Windows Server and Linux instances, we're making it easy for you to combine those together to create. Hey, there it is. So to create combined services that have multiple tiers for different platforms. So you might have. Let's say Apache running on Ubuntu on your front end, and then perhaps you're running SQL Server on the back end. Those combinations are going to be possible, and we're going to make them really easy. And that's, I think, one of the benefits that you'll have in terms of running your workloads on Azure is that we're going to do a great job with Windows, of course, and we're doing our best to do a great job with Linux. So, okay, so now that our VM is up and running, I want to quickly show you how easy it is to remotely manage your Linux virtual machines. So one of the investments that we've made is we've invested in a set of Node.js-based binaries that are scriptable from your Linux client. So as we're talking to customers, one of the things that we learned is that they typically use the command line to configure. I'm sure this is not news to you guys, but you typically use the command line to configure your Linux servers. And so we wanted to make it possible for you to do everything that you can do from the portal directly from your Linux client device from the command line. So we have this set of Node.js-based capabilities, and what they do is they're layered on top of our REST interfaces so that everything that you can do through our REST interfaces programmatically, you can do from these the scripting capabilities. So what I'm doing here is I'm just getting a list of the virtual machines that are associated with my account. So they show up there. Let's say I want to get some information about one of the virtual machine that I just created. So this will go out and give me details, some of the same details that you would see in the portal. And then I even have the option of seeing this output formatted in JSON in case I have some JSON-based tools that I'd like you to use to manipulate the data. So anyway, that's it for the demos. And let's go back and talk a little bit about what was going on behind the scenes. So what happened is, as a user, I opened up the portal, typed in some information to configure my virtual machine. That was sent over to the portal. And then what happened is the platform, from that information, created an ISO that was transferred over to a temporary holding area that contained all the meta information about my VM. From there, the platform grabbed the Ubuntu base image from our set of platform images and created, in my storage account, it created an OS disk for me. And in that OS disk, is contained a set of ICs, or these are drivers, integration components that are drivers that enable Linux to perform well on the hypervisor for Azure. So for instance, the device virtualization capabilities, hardware device virtualization capabilities, are enabled through those ICs. In addition, we have this little Martian guy represents an agent that is also running in the guest operating system and that manages some of the things that make Azure special relative to the Linux guest. So next thing we did is we created a virtual machine, created a local to the virtual machine cache VHD so that access to temporary files is high performance, doesn't have to go over our internal network. We mounted that cache into the guest operating system. Then we mounted the OS disk. And then optionally, you can also create a data disk in your storage account that you can mount into your guest operating system. And then from there, we combined the ISO metadata into the operating system. And there we go. We're up and running, and then the ISO goes away. And then from there, I was able to SSH in and so on. So that's what was happening behind the scenes during that period where I transitioned from the portal over to the slides, then back into SSH. So that's all that I have for the demos of the basic steps involved in getting Linux going on Azure. And so what I'd like to do now is turn it over to Henry and our partners, and we'll have our partners come up and walk you through demos of their products.
Thanks, Ed.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys. So as Todd said, when we set out to build this home for Linux on the cloud, we realized one of the most important things was to partner up with the community. This included both distribution providers as well as important members of that community. We're going to see some of their work right now. And this is just a subset of this full set of partners. And as Todd said, as we're bringing more distributions and more partners, hopefully the experience will be even great, even more enhanced by their contributions. So our first partner is Opscode. So let me introduce George Moberly from Opscode. Opscode is one of our oldest partners. They jumped in right before we even announced internally that we were going to be doing this. So they've been playing with, and I would say playing and suffering sometimes, with a lot of our APIs. And they have seen the platform grow, and they have helped us grow as well. The guys from Opscode have been especially important in understanding the community. They are actually one of the leading cloud infrastructure automation platform frameworks. And through their product called Chef, they are able to create these templates or cookbooks, of which several exist today and are used by most of the enterprise 100 companies. And these are actually used to deploy different workloads. I'll let George talk more about it. Thanks.
All right, great. Good morning, everybody. As Henry said, I'm George Moberly. I'm VP Product Management at Opscode. We're late-stage startup, I guess I would say, headquartered in Seattle, the other side of the lake from the Microsoft campus. So that was actually really handy in working with the guys, obviously, to be able to come on over. So I got 15 minutes. I'm going to try to do some slides. I'm going to try to do some demo. Do any of you know what Chef is? Does anybody in this audience actually know what we do? All right, cool. Well, these guys accepted. How do you guys get in, by the way? I got some hassle from the muscle outside. Okay, good. So, you know, with the time constraints here, we're going to do extremely compressed demo. So, what is Chef? We're an automation platform. So, we're one of the people involved in the DevOps movement. A big thing about us is what we call infrastructure as code, right? So basically, everything you need to do to reconstruct your business from scratch, so from thin, bare metal images that have a base OS load, simple networking, all the way up to fully managed lifecycle of complicated services at web scale. Describing all of that as code that you check in and you manage just like your application source code. In a nutshell, that's what we are. So we have a language that's tuned to the needs of describing infrastructure. That's expressed in what we call recipes. They're bundled in what we call cookbooks. Cookbooks are the unit of distribution that's uploaded into our management server. So our management server is a publishing repository for policies and for data that describes your infrastructure. The server exposes a set of REST APIs that give you a set of automation primitives that you use as sort of a lightweight platform for describing what you want to do. And you have full control, you have full programmability, and you can describe any service you want, anything that can be automated with an API, with a command line, with WMI, you know, whatever it is. If it can be automated, it can be managed with Chef. So in a nutshell, that's what we do. The infrastructure as code is a really core principle for us, and that's what I'm going to be showing a lot in the demo, is sort of how we do that, and then how we sort of model doing a full promotion and continuous delivery pipeline around allowing you to do deployment through continuous build server as part of your development life cycle. So I'll talk a little bit about how we plug into Azure. We have a thing in our architecture component called a Knife Cloud plugin. And it's actually not just cloud. It also, there's versions that work with on-prem virtual infrastructure, on-prem private, physical servers. It doesn't really matter what. This is a component in our system that models how to get bare instances or bare compute started up and managed. And then, you know, that's easy, right? Then the thing that's more interesting is we have a transition point where we bootstrap ourselves. So we bootstrap our management agent. We then associate what we call a role, which is a hierarchy of instructions that basically will march it up, fully configure it, and then orchestrate it together with other servers to create a service. So that's what a Knife Cloud plugin is. In the first phase of our work with Microsoft, what we've done is we've created a Knife plugin for Azure. It's fully capable now. We launched it the same day that Microsoft announced Azure infrastructure. It's available on our website. We have a landing page. You can go grab the source code. It's been open sourced, PASHE2, like the rest of our community content is. And you can go right now, download it, and start following along if you want. You know, I was going to talk really briefly about how we kind of model the Azure object hierarchy to fit within our model, right? So our language talks about servers. You know, I want to do server create, server describe. So we've picked role as the thing that's sort of modeling what is a server. In the object hierarchy, we have role and host. We kind of consider those a single management entity, and that's the thing that we attach disk images to, whether it be OS disk, data disk, instance size, region, all that sort of thing. Those are contained within a hosted service, which we associate one-to-one with a production deployment. That's the entity that's modeling the network that's containing persistent VM roles. And then, of course, you can have many of those within a subscription, which is your API endpoint. Our plugin is a direct REST client. So a lot of what you saw in terms of command line with the Azure command line, we have sort of our spins on those that are sort of chef-flavored. But we're not actually using that client. We're going directly against REST. So this is the command set, image list. You know, what images can I provision? Server delete, server describe, server list, and server create. The one that's interesting from, you know, and maybe slightly unobvious, and probably you can't read this, but this is the help for server create. So server create is the thing that models the bare instance and then gives all of the chef information necessary to say what distro is this, how do I want to bootstrap the chef agent, and then what does it want to become when it grows up. It manages the process of it on power on. It's going to register itself with the chef server. It's going to do a one-time handshake through SSH if it's a Linux instance, or your choice of SSH or WinRM if it's a Windows instance. We support across. We support it's a multi-platform solution. So I highlighted some of the things there that are Azure specific, but you know, basically the task is to wrap that. So what the demo is going to do is going to show an example of embedding that within a continuous build process. And this is a small excerpt from the Jenkins log for doing that. And you can see that what we've done is we have an object in our system called a data bag. That's I'm describing an application instance, so all the settings I need are published as data to our platform. We're then uploading the cookbooks. We're doing that, so if any source code changes have happened to the cookbooks, we've got the current versions up in the management platform. Then I'm launching the instance with Knife, Azure, Server Create, and then the rest of it. And you can see there the run list is saying, what do I want this to be when it grows up? Well, it's going to be running a standalone instance of this application is what it's going to be doing. So just to kind of blow that out a little bit, you can see we've got Knife over there, and then we've got our cloud drivers, right? So we have a variety of cloud drivers. We're going to be showing Azure today. And the automation is going to create thin instances from those. So I'm going to have, you know, bare OS, bare networking. And then everything else, the patching, your agents, your components, your application components, your load balancers, all of that's described as chef recipes. So you can see that we're saying, you know, we're giving it a chef role. One of them is role web server, the other is role database. They're both going to register with the chef server, and they're going to march through all of the recipes that are in this expanded run list after we've applied roles recursively to them. And that's sort of the process, and you run that iteratively over time. You change your policies on the server if you want new patches, you want new versions of your applications deployed, you want to change any data. The client runs periodically, polls, and converges to the state. There's a principle of idempotency that we implement in all of our atomic actions, which mean they're safe to run over and over, basically. And basically, you just run in this management loop. The agent will just check in periodically or just ad hoc if that's the style that you prefer. And they're going to remain configured per the stated policies that are set in the server. So I'm going to skip through this really quickly, but it's just showing how we embed all this in a continuous build process. So whether you're an infrastructure developer or an application developer, you're checking all your stuff into the same source code repository. That's the primary interface for our users, is they check in code, just like, you know, so there's a compile, edit, debug cycle with their set of IDEs and languages, same as the app guys. They check everything in. You establish continuous build with continuous build server, which pulls code, tags it, and then creates application payloads, however that works. How many of you are doing some form or want to do some form of continuous build in your environments? Maybe half. So what we add to the party here is we give you a way of modeling what you want to do out on the deployment side of that. So we have a chef server you're uploading information to. In the demo, we're going to auto-deploy a fully configured instance. And then we have ways of modeling different promotion levels and different environments. So which of these builds is in QA, which is in prod, which is in dev. The continuous build process is auto-updating dev, but I can pin the configuration in different ways in those other environments. And I can create as many environments as I want. I can configure them any way I want. I have full control. Okay, so I'm going to flip to demo here. Is everybody waiting for that web page to come up? Tad did. I know I was. You know, live demos are exciting. Hopefully I'll have as good a luck. Okay, so I've got my portal here. So this is showing all the objects that we're generating through our continuous build environment. The way it works is I'm going to, you know, the demo is really simple. I change an application. So this is J2EE example. I've got Eclipse up. My chef repository is sitting here right along next side of my code. I want to change my logon page here. And I save and I check in. That's it. Demo's over. So what happens is we're launching a build, and we're going to create a new instance, and we're going to wait for it to boot up and bootstrap Chef and install actually all the way down to libc. So it takes about 10 or 15 minutes for this to fully happen. We can watch it churn through, but in the tradition of the cooking show, I'm going to show you what happened last night when I ran it before. So what happens is at the end of the process here, we auto-deploy an instance, and it sends me email. So I get emails here that I've deployed instances. So we'll take, say, this one. This one is a two-server instance. I'm going to show you a little front end we built. So one of the things with Chef is you think of it normally as an embedded solution. You're going to build your own portal. You're going to drive it through our REST API or through command line. You're going to create your own custom tailored solutions. We have our own GUI, but generally people who are using us are embedding us in their own solutions. So hopefully the server's still up from last night, and we've turned on the website. And yes, we have Hello World, which was the logon page as of last night. I log on. So Apache's up, I know that. JBoss is up, I know that, otherwise I wouldn't see this, and I click on this and MySQL is up, yes, because I'm getting data out of the database. So the Chef environment is modeling all those layers as separate things that have code and data. I've modeled it so I can deploy it on one, two, or three servers. I've built a little front end, in fact, that displays every build that happens, comes into a front end here. I can promote them dev, QA, prod. And then if I want to, if I want to deploy another instance here, like I want to deploy another QA instance, I just click on the build, and we have a little front end here where we say, well, do we want to promote or demote, and then do I want to deploy? Do I want to deploy one, two, or three? So let's say we want to do two, and we move the database down here to the second VM, and you can do whatever combination you want, different clouds, different OS. This is just an example, but it kind of displays the kind of thing you can do. I hit commit, and everything's going to happen, and I'm going to get that single email at the end when all that's been orchestrated, and it's really up and ready to test, do load testing or whatever. Maybe this is my functional test configuration, for example. So I'll just show you in the continuous build here, when I did that check-in, I triggered a build. So build number 6 is now in progress. I can look and see what's happening there. I'm actually here, starting to upload the Chef data. The build is done. Now I'm uploading the Chef server. So that's gonna go on. Just kind of running through stuff here. And what we should see is that we've got another. Actually, yeah, we're not at the server create yet. We're just about there. But these are the ones. Actually, these two right here are the ones that I created. The service I showed you. And then we do have a GUI, and we can show nodes under management. The last thing I'm going to show you here is I'm going to take the web front end of the service we just launched, which is going to be this one. And I'll just show you how we've modeled some of the data. So one of the things that this recipe does is it creates an attribute set here that has some specific data that I want to describe how this thing works. So, where's the middle tier? Where's the database running? Well, those are localhost in this case. Where am I grabbing my payloads from? This is an integration between the build server and one of the run servers. Is it listening? So am I a web front end? Yes, I can query on that to decide when to send the email is the way it works in the demo. And then how do I want to configure my Java parameters for my application tier? I can model any kind of parameterization I want. I can templatize it any way I want. And I think I got 1 minute left maybe. I'm just going to show you a little snippet of one of the recipes here. This is part of the recipe for deploying the JBoss layer. And I'm showing here some of the template files. And then I'm passing in these, those are those variables I set, right? What are my JVM parameters? So depending on the node, the environment, the data center, the compliance requirement, the stage of production, I can pass in different values and override them. There's a whole hierarchy of overrides, how you model your data sets. So you can model it any way you want, drive those values down so that they're custom, so you don't change the code. A well-written recipe, you're never going to have to change code in it unless you actually change what the infrastructure is doing. So the code and the data are separated in the way you would want them to be. So I think that's going to be it for me. We've got a great panel at the end. Happy to answer any questions then.
Excellent. Thank you. Thanks so much, George. So one thing that George did not mention is that there's a lot of cookbooks that many of you are probably using today in both for on-premise deployment as well as other clouds. Those cookbooks just map to Azure, so you can just use them. You don't have to go and change them. Let me welcome Donald Butzberg from SUSE. SUSE, as you well know, is one of our oldest partners as a company. And SUSE has a great product that's called SUSE Studio, and we'll actually be looking at SUSE Studio for a different type of experience now, more akin to cloud composition. These guys are actually able to generate different types of images using this tool. And SUSE Studio has been a very good partner for us. And I'm sure you'll appreciate what they've been able to do and how easy it is now to deploy new workloads.
Sweet. Hi, I'm Don Vosburg. I'm from SUSE. I'm actually a field engineer based out of Indianapolis. And so I have a bunch of slides, but I'm not going to show that many slides. I want to get to the demo quickly because you guys are the techies, right? You don't need all the sales stuff. We've been partnering with the Azure people from quite a while ago. We have a history of a good partnership with Microsoft. And we've had a tool called SUSE Studio for a number of years. Now, how many of you have ever tried SUSE Studio? Some of you, good, awesome. Okay, well, I don't have any nice goodies to throw out, but because the interface is pretty intuitive, we've gotten a lot of excellent feedback from some of the people with first experiences and rolling out things like PHP servers and all of that stuff. So this is the sales things that your bosses need and you guys don't, so. Oh yeah, one thing I do want to mention. We are the company formerly known as Novell, right? So basically we were purchased by the Attachmate Group, which is an investment firm, but they made SUSE a separate business unit. So we're actually, I'm a SUSE person now, so I don't have to answer all those questions about are we still around? The answer is yes, we are still around. So now I'm gonna actually do my demo. This should be fun. Okay, so those of you who have seen SUSE Studio, you know that Studio is a web interface. So when I log in, and this is my online account, you can see right at the top, this is sort of like the overview, I have a number of different actions. And on June the 7th, this one magically appeared, where I can manage Azure images. Studio has been an image creation tool for quite a while, but we now have added a connection directly to managing Azure. So I'll show you what that looks like. If I click on the Manage Azure Images, I get this, where I have a number of them that I have already built to be enabled for Azure. Okay? And these ones I've actually already uploaded to the cloud, and they're registered inside of Azure like this. So this is our Azure connection, and I already have these things going. I'm going to quickly go ahead and start a machine build. So I'm going to take a little bit from the previous presenter and be the chef who has the dish already in the oven, so we'll be able to pull it out in time for the 30-second commercial, right? Okay, so I'm going to start at home. I'm going to create a new appliance or a new image. I can choose either OpenSUSE or SUSE Linux Enterprise. Because this pays the bills for me, I think I'll start with SUSE Linux Enterprise. Now, I can go with a number of different choices here. I can pick just enough operating system. I can pick a base server. I can do a GUI. I can do a number of different choices here. Obviously, on Azure, everything is 64-bit, so we're just going to call this one Basic Tech Ed. How's that? Okay, so I'm going to create my appliance, and you can change the name anytime. So once it creates it, it's going to add this kind of a dashboard with these tabs that go across to enable me to flow through the process of building out the machine. Meanwhile, over here on the left, it gives me software information about my system, telling me how many packages I've selected, And by resolving all the dependencies, it's up to 195 without doing anything. So what I'm going to do here is click on software. You can see right here I have a number of sources because I'm Celeste 11 SP2. I have both the Celeste 11 SP1 media and the updates, Celeste 11 SP2 and its updates, and the software developer kit. So I can choose from any of those. If I have my own RPMs, I can click on upload RPMs and put my own packages up there if I wish. If I have a URL for a repository that I know about that I want to add additional software, that's easy to do also. And things that are built in the OpenSUSE build service are directly available in there, and as you search, it will resolve to that. So if I want to add software, I can easily do that here. So if I want to make a web server, I can search for the word LAMP. And it shows me that I have this pattern here that says it's a web and LAMP server. So if I click on it, it tells me all the details that that would do if I were building one. So I can click here and say, look, there's some recommended software that I probably should add. So I'm going to click on Add All and have it add in the recommended software for me. So you can see over here the software changes. Here's what it did. It added all of those things. And I'm going to add the basic pattern for the LAMP server as well. As I'm doing this, it's modifying how much software is over here. It's building things out. It's adding them for me. I want to be able to do my basic systems management on this. If you're a Celeste or a SUSE person, you know that YAST is one of those things. So I'm going to add the YAST ncurses package. And maybe YAST user. If I'm going to make this a web server, I want to do YAST HTTP. And you can see as I'm typing, it's filtering through. Oh, it should be YAST 2 HTTP. It's filtering through all the packages and showing me what I need to. And it's resolving all of that and adding more. You can see over here, it added 24 packages. If I view the details, I can see all the software that this added to my machine. So now that my software is set, and I can actually make mistakes over here, and it will fix it for me. So I'll show you a nice mistake. This is fun. So if I search for the word kernel in here, and I'm going to say, all right, I'm going to add the XEN kernel. Let's see what that does to it, okay? So if I click on XEN kernel base, let's see what happens here. Whoa, it gave me a warning. It says it's not recommended to install more than one kernel in your appliance. So now I got to do something to try to resolve this. So I can just click on remove, and it dynamically fixes the little problem, and my warning message goes away. If I do a really bad thing, like add the kernel XEN, not the base one, I'm going to get a red warning sign saying that I don't know what to do with this. You've installed an XEN kernel. I don't know if this is supposed to be a host or a guest or what you're doing. Come on. Clean it up. So you can clean it up right there. It's very easy. On the configuration side, I have a number of different choices that I can do in configuring. Obviously, I can set my locale. So I'm going to be in English. And we'll pick USA and East Time Zone. As I'm doing this, you can see up here it says saving. So it's writing this out to a profile. So by default, it creates the root user. You can add additional users if you wish. You can change your networking. This one's set to be DHCP. I can personalize it with logos or backgrounds. I can change the run level at startup. So this one by default is just going to a normal console, not a GUI, because there isn't one installed. I can set up MySQL or PostgreSQL, including the tarball, and have it deploy those. I can tell it if I'm creating a virtual machine how much disk space and RAM and swap to use. I can set up a logical volume management as well. I can even integrate with SUSE Manager for patching and other management stuff as well. I can create logins or different scripts. So I'm going to actually add one here because I want to make sure that my Apache service, because this is going to be a web server, I'm just going to add that into my script at the end of the build so that way it becomes a service that gets loaded when I start it up. I could also create scripts whenever it boots and integrate with other pieces like AutoYast. I can add in overlay files if I wish of any kind and put them wherever I want with whatever permissions I want. And then as I build it out, I get these choices for building. So the default format is a USB hard disk stick, hard disk image, which we have a number of customers doing, but that's kind of hard to deploy in the cloud. Just telling you, okay? So we have the your choice down here is to select Azure Image, or I can build it. If I build it with Azure Image as the primary, I can't test drive it in my web browser, but I can go ahead and build it. So we'll make Azure the default format, and I click on Build, and now it starts the build process. So notice that just like the beauty of the cloud is that I can do this from a Flash-enabled web browser on the hotel internet, right? So that's pretty useful, especially if you travel and you don't have your own tools always in front of you. So while this is building and creating an appliance, I'm going to go to the oven and pull out some that we've already baked. Okay, so if I go home and I click on Manage My Azure Images, I can look at this one that I've already made here called TechEd Azure. And you can see I've uploaded a different background to this one. I've chosen some different software pattern. I have got a number of configuration changes that I've actually made. In here, I've added something in my scripts. I've actually added a register sless script that I built that actually uses my correct authorization to register this server to get updates. And then of my build, I set it here to run either a disk image or an Azure image. If I'm looking at a disk image, I can click here on the word test drive, and it actually loads in a browser a Flash version of this server and starts it up for me to edit and modify while I'm trying to create this image. So if I click on the word upload to Azure, it takes me back to this Azure Images console. So any of my images that I have built and whatever version that I have of them, and those increment up automatically, or I can assign those numbers in a meaningful way to me, those would appear here, only the ones that have been built in Azure formats. So once I click here, I've actually managed my credentials for Azure inside of Studio so that it uploads directly into Azure. So now we go back over to the Azure console that we were looking at earlier. And this time when I click on New and Virtual Machine and from the gallery, I have the platform images that we were showing earlier. And I can build from those. Or if I click on My Images, these are the ones that I've actually uploaded from Studio. So I have this one. That's my current build of SLES Machine 2, 3, or whatever. Yeah, that's fine. And this part is a lot like building from Azure, only the difference is that by using Studio, I've already integrated all of the software that I want, all the configuration that I wish, all the uploaded stuff that I want on this guy, and he's going to act like he should. So we'll take a look at, this is my TechEd SLES 11 server that I've created, and you can see over time it's monitoring all of what it's done. I've also made this one an Apache server, so just like he said earlier, on the endpoints, I've already opened up port 80 and port 22 so I can manage it. So if I just click on the URL for this guy, it works, and there's my Apache server, TechEd SLES 11. I can also do OpenSUSE, so we have both SLES and OpenSUSE in here. I have an OpenSUSE machine, here, called NoStudio. So this is one that I built from the platform images that were out there. It takes a little longer because I don't have the same integration, but it's essentially the same thing. It just takes a little more time. So what I've done also is installed on that one the NoMachine client. So, I got a crash, so we'll minimize that. So this is my... this is actually the GUI console for Linux. And those of you who are Windowsy, you'll probably like this better anyway because you guys don't always like the command line, right? Anyway, so this is the way it's going. This is running over, this is a NoMachine client, so it's running over port 22, so I have secure access to the graphical console for Linux, so you don't have to do everything over the command line only. So this is how Studio integrates with Azure, and I'm going to go ahead and pass the torch at this point.
Great. Thanks so much, Don. Quite a neat product, as you can see. So our next partners are, last but not least, our friends from Ubuntu. The Ubuntu community has been working on Juju. So Juju is a different take. It is actually application encapsulation system through charms, where you're able to capture all the information about an application, all the knowledge required, the dependencies, the infrastructure that's required, and you're actually able to write these nifty charms that allow you to deploy it in different clouds. So I'm going to let Kapil here talk to you through the process.
Hi, my name is Kapil Thungavelu. I'm a software developer at Canonical. Canonical provides for development, support, and leadership of the Ubuntu distribution. And I'm here with my colleague, George Castro. We're proud to be part of Microsoft's Azure support on for Linux. And Ubuntu is the most popular operating system in major public cloud environments. So, but I'm not going to talk about that today. Today we're talking about Juju, and I'm going to hand it off to George.
How many of you have heard the term service orchestration before? Oh, excellent. So most of you are going to get your money's worth today. So I'm just going to give you a quick history here in just 1 minute of the problem that we're trying to solve with Juju. So back in the day when you want to deploy stuff, you had bare metal, and things were good, and you would just rack stuff as you needed it. Then along at some point came virtualization, which allowed you to run many different servers on the same hardware, and that really revolutionized the way people deployed things in the data center. Then cloud computing came along, which took virtualization, but you know, kind of gave you nice things like an API on top to let you get instances and things like that. And that enabled people to really launch a lot of instances very quickly on virtualized systems that run on bare metal. Then someone realized, wait, if it's so easy to launch all these servers, I need to manage them all. And then configuration management came along that allows you to manage things at the machine level. We feel that Juju is the next step in the evolution of this process in the data center. And we call it service orchestration, which is not just managing things at the machine level, cloud level, virtualization, bare metal level, but managing things at the service level. So instead of caring about individual VMs or individual cloud providers or the bare metal itself. I want WordPress, I get WordPress. I want MySQL, I get MySQL. So we do this through a process, a set of scripts called charms, which can be written in any language, or you can use tools like Chef in the configuration management step there. And what this allows you to do is abstract all the other stuff in the cloud that you might not care about, unless you really want to care about it. So we, instead of managing things at the specific level, we manage things at the service level, so you can get the elasticity that the cloud provides. Because when you manage relationships between services instead of machines, then you can scale as much as you need to. And Kapil's going to show you that.
So just recapping on what George hit upon, Juju is open source. We have a library of reasonable service definitions, which we call charms. We have roughly 80 charms across for many things. I'll got another slide for that. You can write a service definition in any language, any tools that you want. You can write them in Bash or Perl or Ruby or whatever you like. It's cross-provider. We can go from local laptops to bare metal data center deployments to different cloud providers. And on that note, I want to, here's a list, a quick picture of some of the charms that are available, service definitions that are available. And I want to go ahead and show this on Azure. I'm cheating a little bit, of course. I'm actually running this demo in Azure. I'm just SSH into my laptop. Oh, that doesn't quite show up. I guess I have to get a little bit smaller. Okay. And I'm just running Juju status on it. I've gone ahead and bootstrapped this environment, and bootstrapping from my laptop into the Azure environment. Juju has different pluggable cloud providers. When you bootstrap an environment, you end up running the Juju sort of API servers within that environment, within that cloud provider. So here I've got three machines running. I've got a MySQL service, I've got a WordPress service, and I've connected the two of them together. And internally, as far as what this does within Azure, I could, let's say, add another unit, add some more capacity to MySQL, to WordPress. And let's go ahead and add two of them. So instead of having one machine running WordPress, we'll have a service WordPress with three machines. And this underneath the hood is managing the VMs, the endpoints, blob storage, and disk for these units, for the service. So I can look at SAS again, and it'll show me that I've got several of these things connected together, or several new units that are pending. It takes about 5-6 minutes, I think, for one of these things to come up and get fully provisioned, which is why I have jump-started this demo a little bit. And while we're waiting for that, let's go ahead. So we've got these new units that have come up, and they're pending. I have to expose it. So while they're waiting, let's go ahead and deploy an HA proxy in front of these. We have three different WordPress instances. They're not, we need to stick a load balancer in front of them to go ahead and have traffic round robin between them. So I just said deploy HA proxy. HA proxy is a simple software load balancer. And it went ahead and searched remotely. We have all these charms available in the charm store. It basically pulls from directly from code repositories where these charms live publicly. You can also deploy things that are from private repositories. So we have this concept of namespaces built in, or we have an official namespace of charms which are code reviewed and vetted, as well as the ability for people to manually do their own and push them publicly, or of course you can deploy locally from disk if you want to keep things private. And so Hazmat's my personal namespace in this charm store. So then we want to go ahead and connect the proxy to the WordPress service. So notice I don't care about machines. I'm just using these reusable building blocks like Legos. And they're automatically configuring themselves with each other. Part of the way we're able to do that is that Juju models relationships between services as first-class entities, as sort of bidirectional channels. Let me go back to my presentation slides. So here's an example of sort of deploying from scratch a Rails app connected to MySQL. First thing you do is Juju Bootstrap, which goes ahead and creates the initial API service within the environment. And you can have multiple environments against a single provider. So I could have like 10 environments in Azure, a few in AC2 or wherever, and I could have them, a dev, a prod environment, et cetera. And so I go ahead and deploy my local MySQL charm. I do go ahead and deploy my Rails app. I add a relationship between the two. And then there's this important step where you expose it, where it basically opens up whatever the provider-specific firewalls are. In Azure, for example, this is creating a new endpoint. The charm itself, which is, goes ahead and defines what endpoints, what ports it wants to use. Here's a more complex example of sort of deploying a MediaWiki application with a NFS shared cache, with monitoring using Ganglia, and with NFS shared disk and a memcache for the application server to use, as well as a MySQL database. And then once you've done that, you can go ahead and add new capacity in the same way I did initially with WordPress. You just do add unit or remove unit to any one of these to add or remove capacity. And the load balancer automatically get configured to see the new units go up or down. And all these things are systems are live. So the presence of any, if there's a split in the cloud and some of these machines go away, the system will automatically detect that and reconfigure like the load balancer to take those out of rotation. Here's Hadoop, for example. You can deploy Hadoop master, data node, task tracker, and connect them together. So I wanted to sort of get away from showing you screens of environment configuration. This is actually what it looks like. This is the manifest of a charm. A charm itself is basically a little bit of metadata and then some named executables that get called out for lifecycle events. So taking a look at, this is sort of the metadata.yaml defines sort of what the charm is. This is a simple Node.js app. It basically talks to MySQL, to MongoDB. So it has a requires interface for MongoDB, which defines its relationship to MongoDB. And then it provides a HTTP website. I'll skip over HAProxy. And going back to this manifest, so you have your, inside this hooks directory, you have sort of your named executables for sort of your standard, instance or unit lifecycle events. You've got install, start, stop, et cetera. But the interesting bits are against these relationship events, where we had defined a relationship to MongoDB, we have a relation hook for when we establish a new relationship with lifecycle events around that relationship. So we have around a relation, we have joined, changed, and depart. So each unit of this Node.js app is going to see all the other MongoDB instances that are available. And anytime MongoDB changes its settings or a new unit of MongoDB comes up, say it's in a replica set, then this Node.js app will be able to see that and it configure itself to use that replica set around robin through it. If any of them get depart because there's a network split, you reduce capacity, this hook will be called in the Node.js all the Node.js units, and they can go ahead and remove it from their rotation for connections. So it's sort of a very simple way of modeling these connections between different services and their lifecycle events as hooks that are just named executables that you can define in whatever language you want. As far as interacting back with the rest of the system, let's take a look at a simple one. So if I look at, um, I take a look at the MySQL one here, this is the MySQL install hook. Actually doesn't do anything very interesting. But Juju allows you, so from within these hooks, Juju exports an API, which allows you to, another command line API for you to use when you want to interact with the system. So if you want to go ahead and get the service configuration for some item that you've set, you can get that. If you want to get a relationship setting, each part of every unit in a relationship has its own private settings, and it's able to it's able to set its own settings as well as introspect remote endpoint settings as well. So in this case, whenever you create a relationship to MySQL, it'll go ahead and create a new database for you, create a new username and new password, and set those on its relationship settings. And then the remote side, when it comes up, can go ahead and see that database and configure itself against it. So coming back, and because it's a distributed system, we have lots of little fun tools, like we have a distributed debug log that sort of real-time tells you what everything's doing. We have an interactive way of debugging the system. So let me show you guys that. What did I call it? Sorry, so let's go ahead and run status and see what we have running right now. And so we've started one of the new units. Like I said, they take about 6 minutes each, and of WordPress that we added at the beginning of this, and we're still waiting another one. And Juju offers quick abilities to log in and do various things. This is a full set of commands that Juju offers. And so add relation, add units, bootstrap, get and set service configuration. You can set different instance types with constraints. You basically can use provider-specific ways of getting and setting of prior-specific instance types. You can use them in generic constraints, like I want this much CPU, this much memory, or you can directly pick your instance type. And right now, we haven't set anything on our WordPress service. The debug log is this sort of distributed debug log, all the agents in the system, in sort of real time and in an ordered fashion, will log to log to the console. And of course, you can do things like SSH machines, you can upgrade your terms, so it's full lifecycle management across your service. The key takeaway is that Juju wants to try to be a way to manage services, not machines, and that you're able to do that in an easy fashion that you can define in any language and that you have a library of reusable components to work with. Thank you.
Thanks, Kapil. Great. So I'd like to invite all of our partners now back onto the stage. We are going to be taking your questions, if you have any. And I think it's important to highlight that all of this work had not been possible, would not have been possible if it wasn't for all the wonderful partnerships that we've been able to foster with the community. As you can see, we've strived to create a platform that can be easily extended, and we trust that you will be able to leverage the different tools that our partners have shown here to even extend it beyond what our basic functionality is. So if you have any questions, please. Yes, if you can just approach the microphones.
Just I have one fundamental question related to all the demos we have seen today. Why Azure? I mean, what's the point of having these deployment management tools on Azure versus doing it on Amazon, for example? I mean, I would understand having infrastructure as a service for Windows. It makes a lot of sense to me because I would assume that the future will be will enable ease of integration with these Windows virtual machines with other Azure pieces of code. But I don't understand the benefit of having Linux virtual machine on Azure platform.
So the Okay, so just to make sure I understand the question, that you're asking, what are the benefits of running Linux on Azure versus running it somewhere else, in a sense? Okay, so it's a great question. One of the what we're highlighting here is that in Microsoft's cloud platform, we have the basic capabilities that everyone wants to get started in the cloud. So taking an existing Linux workload, moving it into the cloud, that's something that everyone wants to do today as they get started, right, with cloud computing. But over time, the richness of the cloud platform and the differentiated capabilities of the cloud platform are going to enable lower costs, better performance, better agility, flexibility. And so when you look at our whole host of offerings in Azure, we have some great features that we view as differentiators relative to other cloud platforms. For instance, we have storage capabilities that are differentiated. We have SQL Azure, which is a multi-tenant or shared database capability that's differentiated. We have a web Azure web capability that we just rolled out, also differentiated. So we have a whole ton of features that make Azure special, but this is all about lowering the barriers so you can jump right in and take advantage of those differentiated capabilities with your existing workloads. So this isn't where the innovation stops. This is where the innovation starts from our point of view.
Thanks. Yes.
Early in the presentation, there was a mention on the platforms that are part of the portfolio, including some specific drivers to optimize them with Azure. Is there a way to get those separately so that when we create a virtual hard drive of Linux of our own, that we can integrate that and take advantage of those optimizations as well?
Yes, definitely. There's several ways. So all of the distributions that you've seen endorsed by our partners are actually making available for you to download VHDs that you can create locally. Like, for instance, in the case of Ubuntu, they actually have VHDs that you can link at. In the case of SUSE Studio, you can just use SUSE Studio to create those VHDs. In the case of CentOS, there's detailed steps on how to go from an ISO. The driver, so that's one option. They will already come with the drivers, and you will just have to upload the agent on top of them. The drivers themselves have been open sourced. They are under GPL v2. So if you want to access them, if you go into the Manage Linux website on Windows Azure, on the left side you will see endorsed distributions. If you go there, there's a link also to the drivers. So you're welcome to also recompile them. Yes. Yes, please.
Hi. So I have a complimentary question about the gentleman question here. Is that, if, for example, in our company we have workload and simulation that we can run either on Linux or Windows, and if I want to run them on Linux, I had to to convince my boss about that. So, does the Linux, for example, VHD boot faster? Because like yesterday in the Azure internal presentation, they say that one of the hard limit to booting faster is the fact that Windows Server take 3.5 minutes something to boot. So, can I make them boot faster, or are those IC driver faster or more performant? Can I run my simulation faster on them? So do you have something about that?
That's a very good question. So the Linux image itself, when you download the VHDs, you'll see our Linux images are booting on bare metal in 35 to 45 seconds. So what you're seeing a lot in here is basically the what you're paying is the tax of the UI, of the GUI running on top of it, and some of the delays of the network itself. We are, of course, striving to do better than the 3 minutes to 3 minutes and a half that's taking right now. So you can see that lowering. But you can certainly boot way faster than what you've seen, yes.
Okay.
I just want to add that we're going to be making Windows faster, too. But That's something we're going to keep working on. Yeah, well, you know,
yeah.
we're in a strange place here, but it is the case, you know, today that the Linux kernel does boot very quickly. I don't know that is, if I were going to make the case around which guest operating system to use with my manager, for instance, I don't know if that's what I've sort of pivoted around. There are a bunch of capabilities that separate the two from guest operating system standpoint. Certainly boot time is one of those things. There are others as well, identity integration with other Microsoft services and so on. But anyway, yeah.
And just one more thing also, you know, when we use Azure, you know, Windows Server and application normally, we can scale up and down. And when we scale down, for example, we have a change in configuration, we can do that gracefully in application. And does the Linux, you know, agent or something like that, can do that also when we scale down? Do we kill the machine, or we do that, or can we do that gracefully and handle that change in configuration?
So if you're talking about the size of the VM itself?
No, I mean, like, if I had new VM at some point, I want to remove some of them. Normally, like, currently in Azure with application, we can catch that event in the application and do some, you know, cleaning up before dying. And can we do that in Linux also?
So all of the primitives for virtual machines are actually supported in Linux as well? So yeah, you would be able to do something like
okay.
that.
Okay, yeah. Thanks.
Great. Thanks so much again, and hope you've tried the product. Thanks.